time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at WJCU.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 8th, 2021. Last week, I probably had one of the most interesting conversations ever about food and cycling. To say that Alan Murchison, who's a Scottish Michelin star chef, is passionate about his work might be a gross understatement. He loves cycling, and he loves making food. It's a win-win. His new book, the second in his series, The Cycling Chef, Recipes for Getting Lean and Fueling the Machine, offers up not only some great recipes, but the kind of nutritional information that's also easy to digest. Alan will be with me in a moment. My second guest is Bruce Hagen. Bruce is the people's lawyer in Atlanta and is immersed not only in helping cyclists in the event of crashes, altercations with law enforcement, and teaching police about the laws around cycling, he also is deeply committed to bicycling advocacy, giving back as much as he can. On the road for 80 days this year as the chef for the Canyon SRAM Women's World Team, Alan Murchison has had to learn about the wide variety of palates of his 14 riders from 9 different nationalities. He rises to the occasion with his down-to-earth thinking about food, the people he is serving, and his experience. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest. Where are you? You're in Europe somewhere.
Yeah, I'm in Winchester in Hampshire in the United Kingdom. That's where I am. Yeah, I'm trying to think where I am at the moment.
Well, you have, since this might be audio and you guys can't see it, he's got this really nice espresso machine behind him.
Yeah, it's good. It's a La Marzocca Linea Mini, which is the best coffee machine you can get.
Yes, and I have, I can't remember what mine's called. It's just a little $100 machine, but I love my espresso every morning, right?
Yeah, right. Do you know what? It's been a real sanity check having the coffee machine in the house during lockdown. You know, so you can actually, I love the whole coffee culture. So the fact that I can replicate that at home is pretty cool.
Yeah, well, since the lockdown, my husband has learned to roast our own beans. We owned a coffee shop for many years ago. And so now he brings home a couple pounds of coffee when we need it. And it's pretty awesome. Pretty awesome.
Oh, that's cool.
So I don't often get to speak with a Michelin-starred chef. And you love cycling. In fact, again, if you are not seeing video with this, even though we're recording video, Alan's wearing his kit. He's written a book called The Cycling Chef, Recipes for Getting Lean and Fueling the Machine. And getting lean is something I want to talk about. But how did you become the cycling chef? Tell us about your background.
Okay, so as a young man, I was a pretty good runner. I ran for Scotland, so I was an international runner. And then in my sort of late teens, I went into the Michelin star kitchen environment. So that's all consuming. So anybody that works at that sort of high level has got very little time for anything else other than existing outside the kitchen. So I spent 25 years working, running Michelin star restaurants. I had a Michelin star myself. I had a group of restaurants. I had up to 6 restaurants at one point. And I think in about 2013, this all went horribly wrong. And I walked away from the restaurant business being both physically and emotionally broken with the whole thing. But by that point, I was back cycling because I used to cycle a lot and I got back into it probably about 12 years ago. And there I was, 2013, I thought to myself, right, what am I going to do? I love sport. I know how to cook. And I had a bit of a eureka moment. I saw there was a need for, I would refer to it as the practical application of sports nutrition. And that sounds very wordy, but essentially, most athletes don't care what 1.2 grams of protein per kilo of body weight looks like. they just want to eat well. So I started a business called Performance Chef and started working with athletes. And then it just really snowballed from there, really. So it was through a love of cooking, a love of sport, and then finding a need for a solution. And that's where it came about, really.
This is not your first book. This is your second book.
Yes, indeed.
I don't know why I don't have your first book, but I like this one. I want to talk to you about the recipes that you have and then how you got to know all of this nutritional stuff. So where did you get this nutritional background to know what we need, when we need it? Because you have some interesting ways of looking at it.
Yeah, I think the thing is that a lot of scientists overcomplicate stuff. And I was working in a high performance environment in Michelin star restaurants. And then when I started working in sport, I found at the top of the pyramid, you know, the elite athlete, it was a very similar mindset. It was all about the performance. It was all about delivery and the pressure. And I was training and racing at a fairly good level myself as a master's athlete. And what I was doing and what I saw elite athletes were doing were very, very different. I think a lot of them weren't practicing nutrition. They didn't really understand what they needed and when they needed it, especially in cycling, because let's be honest, if you go out and spend, say, $10,000, $15,000 on a bicycle, you're going to go faster. So often people would go out and they would buy performance gains and not concentrate on the main performance tool they've got, which is themselves. So I read a lot. I worked with a lot of athletes, and it was a lot of sense, really. Like, I'd worked in food all my adult life, you know, and so I knew what worked for myself. And then I was really fortunate that I kind of hooked up in 2015 with a very, very good American athlete called Gwen Jorgensen, who's the reigning Olympic triathlon champion. And her husband and Gwen, Pat, reached out to me in 2015 and said, look, hey, Gwen's doing a box ticking exercise. She wants to win the Olympics. This is what we're going to do. And I went out and started working with them and showed them how to shop and share recipes. And it was then I realized there was a huge correlation between what you ate and the intensity of training. Because at the end of the day, you or I could go out and we could ride for an hour and we could chat and we could take pictures for Instagram and, you know, do it could be really easy. And that could be just like a coffee ride, but you could go out for an hour and it can be disgustingly hard. You could require carbohydrates, you could require protein afterwards. And it was just recognizing that, you know, the way I put it very simply is if you're going on a journey that's 5 hours in your car, you'd never leave home with an empty tank any more than if you were just nipping to the shopping mall to get some food, you know, some shopping. You wouldn't need to fill the tank up. And I try and apply that same kind of logic to food. So what you'll find in the latest book is that the recipes are divided into sectors of for easy days, medium days, and hard days. And the fueling and the food that you need to eat is aligned with the training load. And that's what a lot of people just do not understand. And so often, you know, people go, oh, I eat really well, but I don't have any energy on the bike, or I eat really well, but I'm not losing weight, or I'm not going particularly well. But there's a huge difference between eating well and eating optimally, you know, and that's the thing. It's a huge difference.
Let me reintroduce you. We're talking with Michelin star chef, Alan Murchison. He's written a new book called The Cycling Chef, Recipes for Getting Lean and Fueling the Machine. And what you're saying makes so much sense, you know, that leaving the house for a 5-hour car ride with no gas in the tank, that doesn't make any sense. So you have to gas the tank. So you talk about things like soft pedaling days, pre-race days. Break those down for me. What kinds of things are you recommending for those different kinds of days?
Okay, so if you're going out for an easy day, I always would rein in the amount of carbohydrate you're having and maybe increase your protein and your vegetables. You know, so you don't need to be having huge amounts of carbohydrate, because at the end of the day, carbohydrate is king for cycling energy.
Right.
So you don't need lots of rice, potatoes, pasta, those typical things you do not need on an easy day. However, if the following day you've got a big old session or a big ride, then that's where you'd look at your pre-race or your pre-event food. So it's very much a matter of, on your medium days, maybe mixing it up of having more of a balance of carbohydrate, fat, and protein. And that all sounds really wordy. And what I try to do very much is to say that this is good food and almost traffic light system it. that we make it, you know, easy days, rein in the carbs, harder days, increase your carbohydrate ratio. And that's very simple to do. And my benchmarking really is that everything should be able to be cooked in under half an hour, and everything should also be widely available from your local store. So you don't need to go to 10 places and get all these exotic ingredients, because to be honest, that's how real athletes cook. You know, so elite athletes, they want to make it as simple, as quick, and as easy as possible to get that food in the system. And recreational athletes, like our good selves, I've got jobs, or we've got kids, or we've got other things we need to do. So again, we don't have 2 or 3 hours to be messing about with food. So it's just trying to simplify it where possible.
And that was going to take me to my next question, which is about ingredients. In reading through the book, there are a lot of things I don't know about. Now, posh poached eggs, I can figure that out. But when we get to something like, and where was it? I was just looking at it. There are a couple of these. I'm wondering, how hard is this? Are some of these recipes? Okay. Pumpkin spiced Bircher muesli.
Easy peasy. So it's basically like, it's easy. So basically pumpkin spice. So what does pumpkin spice say to you? You know, it's kind of cinnamon, cloves, you know, there's a little bit of spice in there. And what it is, it's a really good breakfast. So a basic Bircher muesli is oats, Greek yogurt, and milk. Okay, and all we're doing with that, and that is a really good, easy way to start the day, because you've got protein in there, you've got some slow-release carbohydrate, and you're going to have some spiky sugar in there, whether that's honey or maple or raisins or dried fruit. That is a great breakfast. It can be made up the night before. And with the pumpkin spice one, all we're doing is we're just taking some grated pumpkin or carrot, we're mixing it with some spice, and we're putting it through the oats and the yogurt. So what you've got is something that would take you probably 2 minutes to make. You then put it in the fridge overnight, and then the next morning you've got a really good breakfast. So you think, oh my God, pumpkin spice, but it's basically grated vegetables with a bit of spice, yogurt, oats, and milk. That's it. That's the essential basis of a Bircher muesli. And what we also try and do is we try and make things interesting and do flavor profiles that are comfortable and things that don't challenge people too much. So you've got a sweet and sour in there. You know, we've got some cherry flavors in there. We've got some really lovely comforting flavors. Because again, that's me going back to my chef background, is that when you're a chef, you want food to taste good and you want it to be relatable. So all of the dishes that are in there have got really, you know, there's nothing too challenging. And how we test the recipes is I do them initially. I then get my partner, Vicky, to cook them. And then we send them out to athletes that we work with. So every recipe that's in there, you'll see in the back of the book, there's some people that have tested the recipes. We've got everything from Olympic gold medalists through to school teachers that we work with. And we've asked them all to test the recipes. So they've all been tested by elites, and what I refer to as normals have all tested the recipes out.
Normals. I would fall normals. Under normals.
normals is good, because elite athletes are a strange breed. You know what I mean?
They're, you think? You know, yeah.
They're pretty strange. But strange in a good way.
So I like this one a lot. Risotto-ish with red lentils. Yeah. It's not quite risotto, but it is.
But it kind of is. It's the same technique for risotto. But what again, it's a great way of getting protein in there without using lots of meat. And when we were writing this book, we pretty much finished it during the start of lockdown. And it was sort of March, April last year. So 12 months ago, we were finalizing the recipes. And you know what? I think the thing about what's happened in the last 12, 18 months is it's made us look at the environment. It's made us look at our own health. And like that dish, if I'd done that dish 2 years ago, it would have been full of meat. It would have been full of all sorts of exotic ingredients. But we had this situation in the UK that you can get a lot of fresh meat. So I thought, well, what other protein sources can we use? So we used quite a lot of red lentils. There's a cracking recipe in there. And this is a good example. There's probably my favorite recipe in there is a thing. It's called stretch bolognese. So it basically what I do is I take equal quantities of good quality beef mince and red lentils, and we make a bolognese, right? We all can do that. So it's essentially stretching your beef, but you buy better quality meat, then you use less of it. That's good, environmental, ethical stuff to do, you know, and that would be something I'd have again. But then you think, well, what do you do in the real world? Well, I've got some left over, so the next day we'll make it into a chili, or we can make it into like Mexican or sort of oriental style mince. And what we did with the dish is we did a basic one, and then we made a cottage pie. I think I did a chili and I did a Moroccan mince, all from the same base. And realistically, that's how you cook at home. That is how you do it. You make a big batch out and say, well, what we have tomorrow, we don't want to eat the same thing again, but let's make it a bit more interesting. So we thought about really carefully about the end user, that by stretching good quality meat makes sense. And then by adding something to make it different also makes sense. So you can batch cook if you're time poor. Alternatively, it's just a good way of making food more interesting. And that was a kind of lateral thinking behind it, is that I want to make it all accessible and real. And you know, you've probably seen enough chef books that are all towers and foams and fountains and cresses and all that nonsense. This is practical food that works. And, you know, it's got that authenticity with it.
Yeah, you have a good analogy here. Stretch upgrades, like putting wheels on your bike, the same but better.
Absolutely. You just make it a little bit better. And that's it. You know, and it's also trying not to take yourself too seriously with it. It's just, you know, people look at that and they smile with it. And It's kind of cool, because what's great is that all athletes have to perform. And whether you're world class or you just want to be the best in your street, we've all got to eat. And that's the thing that we all share. And the food that's in there is very much like that. And, you know, we've got like on the bike energy balls, like make your own little protein balls. And it's nut butter, it's dates, it's some oats, honey, that's it. But when you roll them up, you do little 40, I'm showing you how to roll balls here. You roll them up, you've got these little 40 gram balls, but that's got 20 grams of carbohydrates. So that's exactly the same as a synthetic gel or a banana. So it's if you want a banana, have a banana. But if you want something that's a bit more interesting, then have this energy ball. Or alternatively, if you want to have a gel, then have a gel. So what we try and do is give people options, but take all the nonsense out of it.
So I want to talk about one more thing before we let people know where to get a copy of, or their copy of, The Cycling Chef. And that is some of these great photographs you have in here. They're black and white mostly.
Yeah.
Throughout, well, you have color photos of food and black and white photos of cycling. So yeah. Where did you get these? These are not new.
No, they're not. And I think it's a nod to the past, is that if you look at food, a lot of the great classic combinations that we love and we enjoy are based on nostalgia. And I think cycling's an awful lot like that. If you look at the most prestigious races in cycling, they've been around for hundreds of years. You know, at the weekend we had the Liège Bastogne Liège. It's been going for over 100 years. And cycling's a really weird sport, that you've got cutting edge technology like Formula One, but then there's still a nod to the past. They still do all these weird old courses and these weird old routes that have been about forever. So it was a nod to the past and the element of nostalgia that we have with cycling. And what we've also tried to do is make sure the cycling pitches are black and white, and then the food really pings. So you've got these beautiful, vibrant colours, and it just makes you want to eat it, really. But I think you learn a lot from the past, and you know, some of the most beautiful cycling routes are routes that people have been doing forever, and they're still really prestigious. And if you look at some of the best combinations, cinnamon and apple, you know, cherry and almond, rum and raisin, you know, you don't need to reinvent the wheel to do something that's really cool. And that's what we've tried to do with the book.
And the book is really cool. So I have one more question. I was going to say no, but I am going to say yes. What's next for you? This was a wonderful project, but it's done. It's published. What's next?
What's next? Well, with books, I've got the next three books basically written in my head. My head's probably not the best place for them to be, as my publisher will tell you. So we'd like to continue to do this. The first book did really well, and it was called The Cycling Chef, Recipes for Performance and Pleasure, I believe. I probably missed the boat a bit with US on that. I don't know what I did with that. I probably was busy. That was published. The second one's out now. And I'd like to do a book. The next book I'd like to do on snacks. I'd like to do sort of 400 calories, maybe maximum. And because at the end of the day, snacking is something we all do. And it's, again, an area that's really unknown for a lot of athletes, is what do you snack and when? I'd like to do a snack book. But to be honest, I'm learning constantly. And at the moment, have the pleasure of working with Canyon SRAM, which is the Women's World Tour team. And we have 14 athletes in the team, and we've got 9 different nationalities. So we're on the road with them quite a lot. I've got a contract that I'm on the road with the athletes for at least 80 days this year. And I'm learning so much about what athletes want, what athletes need. We're doing some really funky low-fiber meals. We're doing a lot of stuff around food timing. And you know what? I pick up so much because in that athletes group, we've got an Israeli athlete, a rider from Belarus, one from Poland. We've got Germans, Americans, British girls, Aussies, Kiwis. We've got this eclectic mixing pot of athletes who all bring little things in. And like the other day, it was a great example. We'd done the Amstel Gold. It was Amstel? I think it was Amstel Gold race. We had a race on the week in midweek. And then I said to the girls, I said, what do you want to eat today? And Kasia, who's our leader for the classics, he's a Polish rider, but her boyfriend's American, boyfriend's Taylor Finney. And you probably heard of him.
Maybe. He was I might have heard of him and his parents.
Yeah, his parents are great. And he's the third best cyclist in his own house.
Right, exactly.
So she goes out with, so you've got this Polish girl who travels the world, who lives in Spain, whose boyfriend's American. And I said to her the other day, what do you fancy for lunch? And she goes, why don't we have a burger bowl? And I'm like, what's a burger bowl? And she goes, it's like a poke bowl, but with a burger on it. And I went, yeah, let's do it. So I did this thing. So we'd use some Polish pickles, but then I did a load of sushi sashimi stuff and we did a burger on it. So it was a really cool thing. And I thought, that's a brilliant dish for the next book. So we did like a healthy coleslaw, a healthy carrot slaw, pickles, but it was vegetables and protein. You think, well, what relevance is that to cycling? And what it was doing, it was giving them a good old dose of protein and loads of veg. So it's helping them recover after a heavy race. But from your perspective, from a normal's perspective, it's like a burger no bun, but not a pretentious burger no bun. So ideas are coming along all the time. And I'm just like a sponge because I know how to cook. And I've cooked a lot and spent many, many hours in restaurants. But it's what understanding what athletes need and then making it relatable and repeatable to other people. So the next book, I believe, will be on snacks. But I've got the ideas for the next 2 performance chef books already there. I've got it there. They're there. I've got them.
Really, really fun.
I've got them written down. I can tell you what's going to be in them. I've got another one, a brilliant dish. So not this, not the snap, but the one after. The burger bowl will be in there. There'll be this really wicked dish that I did at, and I made scrambled eggs at, which is great, scrambled eggs, that's been done. But then I put coconut milk in it and turmeric, and it's so good. It's like coconut, turmeric, a little bit of chili. But again, you think about, well, what benefit is that to an athlete? Because I always think, okay, how's that going to help a cyclist? Okay, so you've got eggs, which is protein. You've got turmeric, which is anti-inflammatory. And you kind of, and then you've got good fats from your coconut. So you think, okay, that all adds up from a science-y perspective. How can I make it really tasty? So it's like, so good. So I've already got all of these ideas, which we're already working on and evolving. The burger bowl, turmeric scrambled eggs, they're already, I've already written them. They're there, they're already there with the stories.
So how is it with all of these athletes in your new team and the languages? Are you having a language issue? Like the Israeli speaks Hebrew. She probably speaks English too.
To be honest, it's fine because the team is, it's essentially, it's an international team because we've got Tiffany Cromwell, who's from Australia. I forgot about Tiff. Crikey, she'd kill me for that. Who's been the longest serving member of the team. And the team's really great to work with because it's the business part of it's German. So it's all very efficient and everything's done on time, you know, very textbook German. And then we've got this beautiful international group of athletes. So English is the language of the team. It's a language pretty much. And then what we've got is all those little inputs that come in, you know, so Tiffany loves pancakes, Cassia loves pickles, Elena, who's from Belarus, but she lives in Italy. It's got this beautiful Italian heritage. And then you've got the Kiwis and the Aussies, which are like magpies. You just pick up little bits from wherever. And then you've got the Americans. So we've got 2 cracking Americans. We've got Alexis Ryan, who's a lovely girl. And then we've got Chloe Geiger. We've not met Chloe yet. She's not been over to Europe yet.
Well, she's just recovering.
Yeah. We've got her who's, you know, she's going to be so good.
Yeah, she is.
Because she's, you know what? I'm so excited by this because She's one of the few athletes that's got the ability to go toe-to-toe with the Dutch girls. We're those big European hitters who are just so strong. And Chloe is, like, honestly, I think it's going to, she's going to disrupt European cycling. I know we're getting off on a bit of a tangent, yeah.
But this is fun. We're allowed to do that.
Well, no, it's great because she's going to bring something because she's got a winning mentality. And that's what we're all there for. We all want to be part of success and we all want to be in part high performance environment. So going back to it, as long as your problem is not because they all need to eat, but they all add a little something. It's a bit like Omer, who's our Israeli athlete. I remember the first time I made hummus and she's got this hummus she makes, which has been a grandmother's recipe. And I got a 9 out of 10 for my hummus. You know, that's like getting a Michelin star, you know? So whenever I make anything that's their traditional food, I'm always a little bit nervous when I do pancakes or smoothie bowls. And I think the other thing that's great about it as well is because we have been on training camps and I've been out riding with them, they trust you. So they trust you when you say, look, right, today we're going to have this meal. It's not the most exciting meal, but it'll help me perform tomorrow. So a great example was last week. We had a really heavy race on Wednesday. So the 2 days previous, we made the food quite simple. So they're having rice pudding for breakfast, fairly low fiber lunches, and then low fiber dinner. So dinner the night before the race is really boring. Plain pasta, plain rice, a basic tomato sauce, grilled chicken, and pesto. Really boring. Greek yogurt and watermelon, because all of those things are low in fiber. And then we do a zucchini salad for them with sweet chili, which is, again, zucchini is one of the lowest fiber vegetables you can get. So it's really boring to eat. But then the day after, I said to them the night before, I said, we got pancakes and smoothie bowls. And the little faces, they all were like, oh, so good. So I did them pancakes. And again, I gave them loads of options. So three of the riders, they had it with passion fruit, mango, fresh pineapple, Greek yogurt, honey. Elena basically got a whole jar of nut butter. It seemed like a whole jar. She's covering it in nut butter. And then Hannah was thinking on speculoos, you know, the biscuit spread. So they can then pimp it themselves. But what I also then do is underpin that by doing a smoothie bowl, which is a smoothie bowl in the book, which is Greek yogurt, it's fresh fruit, it's banana, and it's oats. So we're just keeping on top of the nutrition, but also giving them a bit of treat. But again, that's understanding what the athlete wants, you know, especially female athletes, because they like the fruit, they like the veg. The guys, the men, they're a bit more meat and carbs. They're slightly different. So the language isn't an issue. As long as the food tastes good and visually it looks good and the mouthfeel. Girls are really hot on texture. Really nice textures.
What's so interesting, Alan, is how passionate you are, not only about the food, but about the work you're doing with the team. So I really appreciate everything you've said. I really appreciate you writing the book. Once again, we've been speaking with Alan Murchison. He is a Michelin star chef. He's written a new book, The Cycling Chef, Recipes for Getting Lean and Fueling the Machine. The recipes are simple, easy. We can all do it because I don't love to cook, but since the pandemic started, I cook almost every day and I am so sick of the same old stuff. So I'm excited to try some of your recipes. Thank you for writing the book.
Well, let me know how you get on. And if you start becoming a national level master cyclist, I will take all the credit.
That's going to happen at my age. I don't think so. So tell my listeners where they can get a copy. It's a Bloomsbury, right?
Yeah, it's a Bloomsbury book. So in theory, you should be able to get it from your local bookstore. Or alternatively, you can go probably online and get it. To be honest, it's available in the US. It's got American undertones, so I use cilantro and you've got zucchini in there, so I understand that. And the recipes work. All I would say is my greatest claim to fame is I've never made anybody slower yet.
That's a good one. Alan, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it, and it's been fun to talk with you.
Absolute pleasure.
Alan Murchison's new book, The Cycling Chef, Recipes for Getting Lean and Fueling the Machine, is available now at all the usual places. I'm going to try to make some of these recipes. Those COVID 5 pounds seems to be lingering way longer than I had hoped. So we're going to take a short break, and when we return, I'll introduce you to Bruce Hagen. He's the people's lawyer. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Are back on the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Bruce Hagen has a great perspective on cycling and the law. Apparently, he's also an expert on the Atlanta restaurant scene, too, and in addition to his legal advice, is happy to offer a recommendation about where to eat in his city. Practicing his trade for over 30 years, though, Bruce has been able to bridge some of the gaps between cyclists, police, and legislature, with no illusions as to when things work and when things don't. This conversation will probably not be the last that we have.
Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How's Atlanta?
So great to be here. Atlanta is beautiful. We had 2 days of nonstop pouring rain, and now the sun is out and the pollen is back with it. And so cyclists are sneezing and coughing all over town.
So you sent the rain up to us. We're in Cleveland, and it's just been miserable here for 2 days. So thank you so much for that. We really appreciate that.
You're welcome. And, you know, people in the South have a perception of Cleveland, I think, and Ohio in general, and it was always raining there from our perspective. So this is no surprise to us.
Yeah, but that's not altogether true. I would like to debunk that as we sit here, because spring and summer here are absolutely stunning. We just haven't gotten there yet. That's all. So before we went on the air, which isn't true, it's not really on the air, but before we actually started recording this conversation, you were telling me a little bit about some of the things you do other than being the people's lawyer, like this dining debates. And I thought it was really cute. It was a 1 minute gig, and I watched one, and it was really interesting. What other cool things have you done like that?
Yeah, I mean, realistically, as far as the dining debates thing is concerned, if you're not going to get your restaurant tips from your favorite local lawyer, who are you going to get them from? You
can't
trust food bloggers and folks who try to do this professionally. You need regular people to go and tell you what they think. So, yeah, a friend of mine has this great TV show called Atlanta Eats, and he created a wonderful opportunity for us to sit there and do a point-counterpoint on the hot topics of the day around the food business, such as things like, what's the best order at an Italian restaurant? Is it pizza or pasta? What do you get at a deli? Is it pastrami? Is it roast beef? Where do you sit when you're out on date night? Do you want an intimate table for two, or do you want a spot at the bar? So I've yet to have anybody hire me based on my food recommendations, but it certainly is a lot of fun. And so separate from that, you know, I'm a frequent commentator on a sports talk radio station when they need somebody to just talk about various topics of athletes getting in trouble or any kind of controversy in the sports world. I've been on an animated show called Archer, where my character was drawn, or my face was drawn into a character. And I don't know, just sort of being out and about in the mix of Atlanta has led me down some weird paths besides just being a personal injury lawyer who helps bicyclists. So that's my day job, but the rest of it really is kind of fun.
It sounds like a lot of fun. Let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Bruce Hagen. He is the people's lawyer, and the people are you and me, the people who ride bicycles especially. And that is what we're going to talk about. So tell us a little bit about your background. I know you are part of the Bike Law Network, and in full disclosure, Bike Law is a supporter of the Outspoken Cyclist podcast. So I want to make sure that people do understand that. And yet, you are not paying me to be here, and I am not paying you. So
I'm open to payment if it was never mentioned, but now that you bring it up.
Sure. We'll talk about that. So tell me about your work and about you.
Sure. So I've been a lawyer here in Atlanta since 1986, when I got out of law school and moved down here from New York originally, and grew up riding bikes, and it was a big part of my life. as a lot of folks, but I never really thought of it as anything that I could build a career around. And I did some various things in the legal field until I opened up my own firm in 1992, doing a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Gradually, that honed in on personal injury, and the people's lawyer moniker came about. I didn't dub myself that. Somebody else gave me that name. But it's mainly because I would take any meritorious case that came along and be willing to bring it all the way to trial because I was just scrappy and on the side of people as opposed to the side of insurance companies. And it was me versus insurance companies. And I really liked that dynamic. And so I tried lots and lots of cases. I mean, I probably tried close to 200 cases over the course of my career, which may not sound like a lot to some, but it is a lot as far as trial lawyers go. And then probably right about late 90s, I met a lawyer a good bit older than me, a guy named Ken Roscoff, who had a small personal injury practice, and he only represented bicyclists, which I thought was a pretty interesting niche. And he was kind of winding down his practice a little bit. He certainly didn't need much structure around him. He just needed a place to hang his hat and call an office. And so he moved in with me and we started working together. And what I learned from him was that there's so much more to helping a community than just saying, I'm here to help you with your case. Ken taught me the value of being part of something and being part of a larger group that you can be accountable to. You can help in many ways beyond just the advocacy you do in the courtroom. And it really opened my eyes and in a lot of ways, because it also rekindled in me what had become a dormant love of cycling. So Ken got me on a bike. I mean, he's now 82 years old. He can still kick my tail on a bike. And a lot of people are in that category because he's a monster on the bike, even though he's winded down his practice. But really, you know, the importance of, look, there's an underserved community of cyclists out there that is just abused by the public, is abused by drivers, is misunderstood, and certainly in terms of how they're treated in court and under the law, is not getting the respect that they deserve. And it's a community that is certainly worthy of our support. And so I started handling bicycle cases with Ken, and that led to other advocacy opportunities, like what else can I do here? Ken was always a believer in giving back, and he instilled that in me, and I've taken that to the next level of, hey, look, you know, we can carve out a niche and make a living here by helping folks in our community when they need us. Let's do what we can to give back to that community. And so we both support our statewide advocacy groups as much as possible. Georgia Bikes is a statewide group that does a lot at the legislature and a lot of public education. Atlanta Bicycle Coalition is another group that we support that does a tremendous amount of work to try to help make cycling more readily accessible to folks of all income levels and all abilities here in the city of Atlanta. And they do incredible work. And so through that, I've started providing free educational seminars for riding clubs, for school kids, for police officers. We train police officers on bike laws. It's probably not surprising to your listeners, but it is shocking still how many law officers just either aren't familiar with the bike laws or are willfully ignorant of bike laws, and who really, when it comes to investigating crashes involving bicyclists, have either a latent bias or a very specific bias against us. So talking to them and trying to just, number one, provide them with the baseline education on the law and on cyclist behavior has been huge. And then trying to get them to just approach crash sites from a neutral perspective without assuming before they get there that, okay, I'm going to a crash of car versus bicycle. I'm assuming the bicycle did something wrong. I'm going to now look for evidence that supports that assumption, which I fear is something that goes on all too often in bike crashes. So that's a big part of what we do. I've gotten involved tremendously at the legislature of trying to help Georgia enact laws that will make it safer for folks to be on the road, that will penalize drivers. And, you know, we're very much in tune with what's happening there. And thankfully, being part of the Bike Law Network connects me to folks in other communities and states where I can see what their successes are, what their failures are, and use that as much as possible as we speak to the folks here in Georgia to try to bring us along. So, you know, we're not necessarily the most progressive state, but we're certainly not among the worst. And I feel that the atmosphere here in our state, and certainly in Atlanta, for cycling is improving on a daily basis. More and more people are taking to the streets riding. COVID has accelerated that, as it has all over the place. Atlanta has experienced huge density inside the city limits, and just a tremendous number of young people moving here, moving into communities where they really don't need cars. They're turning their backs, I think, on the car-centric lifestyle. And without having a great public transit system, the bicycle is becoming more and more popular with young people as a means to get around. The last thing we've seen here is that we have some great infrastructure, something called the Atlanta Beltline, which is a rails to trails project that has gone right through the heart of the city. Eventually, it will become a 22-mile loop around the city. Well, when it's fully built out, it's only partially built out now. But even the parts that have been built already have just transformed the city in so many positive ways, some negative ways involving conflict between people on bikes, pedestrians, people on mobile scooters and other devices. So we're dealing with some growing pains there, but it's really just gotten people aware that there's so much more to life outside of your car. And you can see that there was this pent up hunger among the community here for folks to just try to live an active lifestyle and be out of the car. Any nice day here in Atlanta, and the Beltline is packed. It's become an incredible attraction. And, you know, it's got its growing pains, like you said, but it's been fantastic.
We're going to take a real short break, and we're going to be back to speak with Bruce some more. We're speaking with Bruce Hagen. He is the people's lawyer, and the people, meaning you and me, especially bicyclists and pedestrians, important distinction there. We also, I want to talk about when we come back, some of the things that are happening with trails and paths, and in your case, the Beltline. We're going to take this break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm speaking with Bruce Hagen. He's in Atlanta. He's an attorney, and he helps cyclists. And some of the things you said in the first half of our conversation were not only interesting, but they were heartening. Things about working with the police so that they can understand bicycle laws and not look at the cyclist as being at fault the moment they hear there's a crash of some sort. I think that's really important. And I'm hoping that other jurisdictions, other agencies around will hear that and know that it's possible. You don't have to just look at the bicyclist and say, oh, he or she must have been doing something wrong.
Yeah, and you know, the whole mission for the police is to protect and serve, right? And
so allegedly,
a big part of that is protecting and serving your community. Well, that includes the people who are out there riding bikes. And so why wouldn't you want to arm yourself with as much knowledge of cyclist behavior as possible? Certainly, as a bare minimum, you should know the law. And so years ago, there was an incident where somebody had captured a what looked like a punishment pass, but a very close pass on video. And when you looked at the video carefully, you realized that the car that just missed hitting the cyclist was actually a police car from a local municipality. And the local municipality, of course, they put the video out there. The cyclist put the video on the city's website, and the city police chief said, you know, we apologize and we're going to do our part to try to make sure that our officers are up to speed and knowledgeable about bike laws and respecting the safety of folks in our community who ride bikes. And so I just reached out and contacted the police chief and said, hey, if you're serious about this, let me come in and train your officers. And so amazingly, he responded to me and said, yes, I'm serious about it. When can you come? And it led to two nights of training their entire police force on bike law. And that was the first time we'd done it. We've come up with a program so the officers can get credit for continuing education. And, you know, we're able to go ahead and talk to them. And, you know, I feel like in any group, I've probably done this a dozen times. I feel like you can break down the officers into three categories. There's a third of them who are genuinely interested in hearing what you have to say and are trying to learn something new. There's another third who are there because their commanding officer told them that they needed to be there. And then there's a third of them who are probably looking to get some knowledge here so that they can find a way to screw with cyclists in the future.
Wow.
And so, you know, I'd love to say I can convert those third.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have an agenda, and it's hard to get past that. So I don't think that I'm able to really turn those guys around as much as I try to. And I do this by humanizing them. And there's always some officers who are fellow riders. So you can, you know, use these guys as examples. But, you know, you just try to humanize who we are and that, you know, we're your neighbor and your teacher and your kid's little league coach and, you know, everybody else that you meet. It's just we happen to be occasionally on bike. And, you know, when that happens, we don't lose our humanity. We don't lose our dignity and rights, even though all you see is somebody perhaps in spandex that you can't quite get comfortable with, you know. And so, but, you know, we have to also be accountable to our community. And when I speak to riding clubs and I talk to them about, you know, the feedback I get from police officers, you know, you come to realize that we all want the protection that the law provides. But to some extent, that also requires submitting to those laws and adhering to those laws. And a lot of us don't like to do that. You know, not every stop sign is one that we feel that we should have to stop at. And Georgia doesn't have an Idaho stop law. We don't have yield to stop yet. So, you know, I hear this from police officers. Oh, you know, cyclists run stop signs. They run red lights. It's like, yeah, you know, sometimes you're right. Nobody gets killed usually when that happens, as opposed to when cars do it. But yes, that's true. And then they complain that, you know, these cyclists ride two abreast. It's like, okay, well, did you know that that's legal? You know,
I mean, right, exactly.
Yeah. So some of the things that they use as a way to have prejudices against people who ride are just misunderstandings of the law. I mean, you know, we have plenty of folks in groups who say, you know, police cars come up to them and are shouting at them through their bullhorn, you know, get on the sidewalk. They should know that that's illegal and in fact, more dangerous than being in the street. But, you know, that kind of ignorance then leads to hostility, and hostility leads to dangerous conditions and, you know, people not getting treated fairly. I've seen way too many cases. We've got one right now that is as frustrating as can be, where you would never see a report written the way it's written if it were car versus car, even car versus pedestrian. But because it's car versus bicycle, they'll find ways to put the fault on the person riding the bicycle, contorting the law, contorting the facts, just to try to find a way to absolve the driver. And it's infuriating, and it's a fight that we fight on a pretty regular basis.
Wow. We're going to take a left turn because there's something I want to talk about that does not have to do with cars, and that is paths, trails and paths. Lots of things are happening that people, you know, everybody's riding now gravel, off-road, all-purpose trails, your beltway, our towpath here. And there's some issues that are going on and not always clear when something happens. For example, a bicyclist hitting a pedestrian, or an e-bike overtaking cycling and then somebody crashes. So you actually have some experience with this and you had some things to say about this. Tell me what you know about this and what we should know.
Well, you know, it's a developing area, right? And especially where we have some of these, you know, urban areas where you've got highly populated trails that are used by pedestrians as well as cyclists. And so I mentioned the Beltline here in Atlanta, but you know they're springing up in cities all over the place. And even in the outlying areas, the Beltline has been so successful, both socially, from the standpoint of helping people to functionally commute and get from place to place, but also with the development that's gone on in blighted communities that have been developed now. And so other cities are seeing this like, hey, we want a Beltline. So, you know, you're starting to see projects like this all over. But the conflict between pedestrians and bikes is very real. And it's one that is hard to figure out. And the e-bike thing, unfortunately, is very nuanced and difficult to enforce. You know, ultimately, I think you could say the easiest rule to follow is just simple, basic courtesy. If you just tell people be nice and be considerate of the other people around you, I feel like 99% of the problems would disappear. But, you know, folks who are walking their dog or just out with a stroller, or just even out with friends talking, they're moving at a slower pace, obviously, than anybody just on any bike. And then you've got folks on e-bikes who might be going even faster, right? You got some folks who are committed to trying to become king of the mountain and set a time trial record at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon on a hugely populated 14-foot wide track of concrete, no matter how many people are out there, and they're flying by, you know? And so it's like, look, if we could just have a basic consideration and just give way to the slower moving, more vulnerable entity, a person, right? It seems like these things are avoided. You know, one thing, I just read a thread on this, which should be pretty simple, of, hey, do you ring a bell or say on your left when you're passing somebody on one of these trails? And, you know, the discussion was really surprising a lot of ways, because some folks say, you know, if I say on your left, that's a sure way to get somebody to just jump to their left. Or, you know, I say on your left, somebody's wearing headphones, they don't hear me saying it, so I shout on your left, and then I have to shout so loud that by the time they hear me, they jump, and that makes them more unpredictable. I'd rather just buzz by them without them knowing that I'm there. And yet, you know, one slight movement, and certainly when you got kids involved, people get knocked down. It's made even more unpredictable by things like these e-scooters, and we have these mini. They're not really bikes. They're not really scooters. They're just kind of a hybrid that we see folks going in. And I don't know what is, even the most experienced rider seems like it's the first time they're using it every time. You know, it's serpentine down yeah. the path. And so, you know, everybody's in danger. I remember I had some friends visiting. We were just out walking on the Beltline. They had a 5-year-old or 4-year-old kid. I've never been so nervous in my life. I mean, because, you know, how are you going to tell this kid, walk in a straight line, stay to the right third of the roadway here. Don't deviate left or right because you might run it, you know, get run over by a jogger or a person on a bike. It was terrifying. And so, you know, for people on bikes who get frustrated, I say, look, understand who's there. And if you're frustrated, go ride out on the road, right? It's like, well, okay. But then when I'm on the road, people are saying, get off the road. So you know, the fact is that if you are considerate on a bike and expect that same consideration from others when you're on the road, you know, I think that's the world we want to live in and can all live in and, you know, both give respect and be respected.
I know that when you're in a boat, for example, on the water, there are specific rules of who gives way to whom. So, you know, like the least guy is the sailboat, and then there's the powerboat, and there's the maybe the canoe in there somewhere, and then there's the big boat. And so you're always supposed to defer to somebody. Is there that kind of rule on a path or a trail that if somebody does get into trouble, how do you decipher who's at fault?
I think that's a great example, by the way, and one I hadn't really thought about applying to these situations of folks on the path. But to me, it's as simple as, you know, who is slower moving? The walker is slower moving than the person on the bicycle. The person on the e-bike may be faster moving. We've had some conflicts here. I had a person contact me who owned a e-bike company that was adjacent to a trail. And there was a rule that there were no motorized vehicles to be on the trail. And this went back to prior to e-bikes come along. It was really about mopeds. They didn't want gas-powered mopeds on this trail, which is understandable. And so I'm speaking to the city commissioners and folks that, you know, it sounds like what you're really looking for is has nothing to do with the device that somebody's on, because let's face it, you can legislate for a device that we have here in 2021. And by 2023, you know, there'll be something that none of us even anticipated that operates in an entirely different way, you know, floating hoverboards that shoot jets of water out the back of them.
Right.
But so it's not a matter of trying to go one device at a time. It really is an issue of speed and right of way, you know, and if you just say that, you know, the most vulnerable ones have right of way that others should yield to them, then you're saying, okay, you know, bikes yield to walkers, e-bikes yield to slower bikes. Give an audible signal when you're passing somebody. And then for the walkers themselves, you know, don't stop in the middle of the path. Don't walk your quadruple stroller and your dog on a retractable leash that takes up the entire path. You know, have some consideration that there are people coming from behind you and in front of you. So, you know, I think that to answer your question, there really are no fleshed out rules of the trail in the way that there are rules of navigable waters or rules of the road. It's more akin to driving in a parking lot of a shopping center, where there's a suggestion of lanes and a suggestion of rules, but it's more a matter of, okay, if I'm going along this aisle, I need to watch out for cars backing out. And before I go into that row, I need to watch out for people and other vehicles that might already be there.
So what would you...
So what I've seen, I'm sorry to just keep rambling,
that's okay.
But what I've also seen is that individual trails will have their own set of posted rules. And so, you know, some people are like, well, we need more signage. That's helpful and certainly something that should be done. But the reality is you can become overwhelmed with signs and then, you know, everybody just kind of ignores them.
Which is where I was going. What would be wrong with having universal trail use protocols? And then exactly what you said, people will just blow them off. They won't look at them.
Well, but there's nothing wrong with it. And it's a good aspirational thing to say that, hey, look, it doesn't matter where you are.
Right.
These goals and these protocols here work. And so we encourage you at the local level to institute these on your trails. And then, you know, to have folks out there who are willing to monitor it and abide by it. But, you know, I think if we get to the point of traffic cops giving citations to folks on bikes who aren't ringing their bell when they pass somebody, or you know, someone on an electric scooter that is zipping in and out and weaving without consideration for other folks, you know, I sort of feel the way that, like I do about the super speeders and the aggressive drivers. I would love to see those people get pulled over, which never happens. And yet, you know, do I want to have officers along the side of the road, you know, pulling over folks left and right? I don't really want that either.
Right, right. That's all true. The last thing I want to talk about, it's all good food for thought.
The last thing, I thought we were just getting started. I've got so much more to talk about, Diane.
Well, geez, doesn't mean you can't come back.
Okay.
But that was going to be, so there were two things I was going to get to. We're already almost at a half hour, which is fine with me. This could go on forever. And maybe what we should do is just keep talking and we'll split it up into two shows. That's okay with me too.
Anything you want.
Well,
my rate is the same for 20 minutes as it is for 2 hours.
That's interesting. I love it. That's a good rate. I know what that rate is, at least for this conversation. I wanted to talk about infrastructure as being the word of the day. And meaning on a sort of a universal level at that high-end Washington, D.C. level, and how it may or may not trickle down to places like Atlanta and Cleveland and Dayton and wherever, and what your parting thoughts are today. So, you know, pick the one you want to go for today, and then we'll make a date to talk again, because I think we do have a lot more to talk about.
Thank you. You know, the infrastructure thing is great and critical, and for a while I was really in the camp that it doesn't matter what kind of laws we pass, it doesn't matter what sort of education we have, if there's not the infrastructure to support the needs of cyclists, then none of it really matters. I still kind of feel that way, but you know, ultimately the infrastructure spending becomes a matter of political will. And as much as we try, I just don't see the political will beyond this kind of lip service that we seem to get that, you know, we care about cycling, you know, community, city, a county, we care, but we just don't care enough to really redesign our streets in a way that makes sense for folks who are not in cars. We're seeing it little by little, but ultimately it's just going to be, I think, a matter of folks who are in power coming to this conclusion that we have to be willing to spend the money. Spending the money requires commitment. That commitment comes from knowing that you got the mandate of the voters. And, you know, who are the voters? They're the same people who are out there driving around thinking that we don't belong on the road because we don't pay taxes, you know, and other just
so
ludicrous
true.
Ideas. So I just don't know that we have the clout to get that kind of mass spending done fast enough to save any of the lives of anybody who's listening to this podcast. I do think that greater consideration and greater concern, and certainly education, enforcement of laws, better laws, combined with more people riding, is the key. And I feel that at this point, the safest thing you can do as someone who rides a bike is encourage somebody else to ride a bike. That there really is safety in numbers. And cars may hate it. They may feel burdened by it. And cars, I'm talking about drivers. But the reality is, the more of us that are out there, the more they see us, and the more they are comfortable around us, and the more they adapt to us. And ultimately, that's what I think takes for us to be safe. I'd be very happy to live in a world where I can no longer use my skill set as a trial lawyer representing injured bicyclists. I've got like one or two other marketable skills, and I could put them to work. But, you know, I'd be happy with that. I'd be happy if my wife wouldn't get so nervous when I left the house on my bike, wondering if I'm going to make it home or today's going to be my day. So anything I can do in that regard, and it's, yeah, lobbying politicians certainly to show them that, you know, there are people on bikes who both support politicians that support us and vote for politicians that support us is certainly a good way to get some attention. I just don't know that the numbers are there for any sort of widespread, massive infrastructure spend when I hear of all the dollars that are being proposed, and the primary goal of that is, what can we do to move cars faster and more efficiently, as opposed to how can we redefine the way that people get around, especially in urban areas?
Well, I think, and this is going to take a moment, and I don't really care at this point because it's a podcast. We can have it as long as we want. I think there is a growing, there is a growing number of people who are in planning, in legislation, in law, like you, legal people, riders, who are showing up. People like Transportation Secretary Buttigieg, people like Gabe Klein, some of the planners like Jeff Speck and Chuck Barone, who talk about strong towns and how cities need to change. And some of it is economic. So I know that—
Absolutely.
And money talks.
Yeah, and I mean, look, I remember a few years ago, I was in Austin, Texas, and I was reading about a brand new apartment building that was coming into their downtown. And the interesting thing was that it had no parking. And this was sort of in the early days of Uber and the early days of bicycle rideshare. And these developers said, look, you know, we can build a building. The type of tenants who are going to live here, a lot of them don't ride or need cars, or if they do need a car, they'll take a shared vehicle like an Uber. They ride bikes and they take public transit. And so you realize like, hey, if we don't have three levels of parking deck in our building, that means we can have three more levels of rentable units to rent our apartment.
Isn't that interesting?
And so there's an economic model there,
right,
that makes sense. And then you have a walkable community.
Right,
which
right.
People love that, right? We should all love that. I mean, I was talking to this one guy here in Atlanta. We were doing a protest ride on this one high-speed corridor that is really a dangerous area that should be a great thoroughfare for bikes, right? I mean, it's ideal for it, and yet cars come zooming by there, and the city does nothing to try to do anything other than encourage cars to move quickly. And so we had series of bike protests out there. And on one of them, this guy I'm riding with, who's a fellow lawyer and a fellow cyclist, says, you know, look, I get it. I see what you're trying to do here and everything. But, you know, I can't imagine that, you know, I should have to get on the bike to go ride my bike 2 miles just to go get ice cream. And I'm thinking to myself, man, isn't that exactly what you should be doing? how great is that? Why would you get in the car,
right,
to go get ice cream for, you know, go 2 miles from your home and you know where you park there, you use gas, you park, you go somewhere else, and now you're going to get back in the car as opposed to just hop on a bike, 10 minutes later, you know, 15 minutes later, you're getting an ice cream cone. Don't you want to feel safe doing that and live in a community where that's the norm, you know? And so it takes some rewiring for folks to see it. You kind of feel like everybody in America needs to go and spend at least a month living in Europe where folks are, you know, living on their bikes and getting around on bikes. And you realize like, okay, yeah, we can do this. We can do this.
We can do this. Well, geez, Bruce, this has just been an amazing conversation, and I am going to reserve the right to invite you back to talk some more. We've been speaking with Bruce Hagen. He is the people's attorney down in Atlanta. It's hagen-law.com. So if you find yourself in a situation in the Atlanta area, by all means, you can go to his website, which is, it is hagen-law, right?
That's it. Or if someone is traveling through Atlanta and needs a restaurant recommendation, happy to help with that as well.
Yes, by all means. Well, thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with me today. It's been a pleasure. And I'm going to thank Bob Mianski again for recommending talking to you because I really like the way you think.
I will as well. And thank you. And I love the Outspoken podcast and keep doing what you're doing. It's great. And I'm so glad you're out there promoting cycling and people in the cycling world. It's just great, and I appreciate you in many, many ways.
Thank you so much. You have a wonderful day.
You too.
Bruce Hagen joined me from his office in Atlanta at Hagen Law. If you are in need of his services in the Atlanta area or wish to learn more about his work, you can log on to hagen-law.com. And if you want to see one of the Atlanta Eats episodes, head on over to our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, and click the link for today's podcast. My thanks to Alan Murchison and Bruce Hagen for being my guests this week, and my thanks to you for listening. I'll be back next week with a brand new episode of The Outspoken Cyclist, and if you want to know what's going on in the meantime, head on over to our Facebook page and join one of the conversations. You can always leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, too. I hope you have a great week. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.